AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 49 for Thursday, April 1st, 2010. Wild Horses. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Well, here it is Thursday night. We're back at it again, back at it for AutoLine After Hours. And sitting in the chair, usually sat in by the Auto Extremist, but the Auto Extremist is not here with us tonight, is David Welch, who we haven't had in a couple of weeks, and it's great to have you back here, David.
Glad to be back, John. Yeah, I missed being here, but I was in New York for a couple of weeks of training, but now I'm back and usurping the throne.
You're almost wearing all black, too.
Yeah.
If you had a black T-shirt, then it would be the full outfit. Right.
Well, but I've got my Easter colors on.
Yeah, you do. Boy, very Easter-y. Pink and lime green and a very bright tie that you've got on there.
Maybe this is the synergy green like they have on that Camaro.
Well, funny that you should mention Camaro, and our audience will know about that in just a minute. And also joining us is Riley Brennan from AOL Autos. Great having you here.
Thank you very much. Ike has given me a warm reception here.
Oh, yeah. Ike appreciates all automotive enthusiasts.
Right.
Thank you for having me. If the audience or anybody in the audience doesn't know, what is AOL Autos?
AOL Autos is a widely trafficked car shopping site. And, we've been around for a while, but we've never really had original content. And so the last year or two, we've really been working on that and get about 6-7 million people a month. And AOL Autos.
And you're the chief editor of all the...
I'm the editor-in-chief, as hard as that is to believe.
Yeah.
And we have about 25 writers.
25?
Yeah, some of whom have been on the show. So
yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So, yeah, it's fun.
That's cool. And also joining us today is Dave Parasek from... chief engineer for the Ford Mustang.
And, yes, sir.
And wow, just before the show here, you let me get in the 5-liter and drive it, and zowie. I mean,
that's in the press.
It's a
remarkably good engine. Now, I only test drove it out of here a little bit, but we
obeying all the rules, obviously.
Obeying all the speed limits, of course, as we always do. Religiously. So tell us a little bit about how'd you get involved on the Mustang? You know, you've been at Ford for how long?
About 16 years.
16 years, yep. And already chief engineer on the Mustang.
Yeah, it's been a wild ride at Ford. It's been very good. I've been able to experience many different facets of the business. So I've been in the studio. I've been in electrical. I've been in manufacturing. And I was the chief engineer of our D platform, which is our Taurus, our MKT, our Flex. And they came to me about 2 years ago and said, we're looking to turn the reins over to someone, and we want you to take them. And so it took me about a half a second, and I responded. And it's just been a great ride. I mean, it's a fantastic, you know, product. It's an icon, obviously. And it's a heck of a responsibility, but it's one that I thoroughly enjoy.
How many letters did you get the first day that you people found out? Oh. People write from all corners of the country saying, make sure you do this and make sure you don't do that.
Oh, yeah, you know what? We are not shy of people putting their input into what a Mustang should be and what our next move ought to be. So I get email all the time, which is really cool. You know, we get mail. People within the company that feel that, you know, I mean, everybody's got their ideas. So it's pretty awesome, actually. Everybody wants to be a part of what Mustang stands for. So it's pretty cool. So
how much liberty do you have to change the car from generation to generation? Because it's got to be a certain thing. There are certain expectations, and the company's going to put so much importance on it. How much liberty do you really have to kind of tear things up?
Yeah, no, you know, I actually do have quite a bit of liberty to do that. And, you know, the company's dedicated. The one good thing about Mustang is that we have full support from our senior management. And so that's really encouraging because they want this car to be what it's been for the past 45 years, which is nothing but outstanding. And so they're backing everything we're doing. And with the 2011, you know, hopefully you all drove it today. You can see that we're committed to taking this thing to the next level. And we've done that with the 2011 for sure.
Well, remember in the mid-90s, the Mustang was almost killed. Wasn't it mid-90s?
Isn't every 7 or 8 years the Mustang was almost killed?
Well, yeah, it was almost killed in the early 80s and gutted. And then there was a point where it was going to go front-wheel drive. And it was going to be what later became the Probe. And somebody in the company came to their senses and said, whoa, what are we doing here? Yeah. So they left the Probe as that, and the
which
Mustang
great, by
stayed.
The way, which I still kind of miss, that Probe GT.
The Probe GT was a pretty nicely, still looks good today.
Yeah, it was a nice car. I mean, we've been in business for 45 consecutive years. There's only one other sports car that can actually say they've been in longer than us. You know what it is?
Another sports car, more than 45
years? We've been 45 consecutive years. There's only one other sports car. That
Corvette.
Can, that's right.
That's
it. That's right.
Years.
Yeah.
That's right.
Except 57. For 1983, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
So really, you have the Mustang.
That's true. That's true.
Well, they never stopped building
cars. They didn't build it. They didn't stop building it.
Right. Model year.
The model year.
Yeah, skipped it. But
so last year, the Mustang body was redesigned and the interior.
Yeah.
This year, you guys are dropping in two new engines.
That's right.
3.4 liter?
3.7 liter.
3.7 V6,
yep.
Excuse me. And a 5-liter V8.
That's right.
Now, why 5 liters? I mean, I know the whole history and all that.
Oh, come on, John.
Is it 5.0? Is it just purely marketing that you said it's got to be 5 liters?
No, I mean, I'll tell you, we hear from our customer base all the time, and they've been this engine has been in anticipation for quite some time.
Well, why didn't you make it a 302 instead of a 5-liter?
Well, this is 302 cubic inch, and this is a true 5-liter. So for those who know their history, they know that maybe the last one wasn't exactly 5 liters.
Then you got to have badges that say 302.
You don't like the 5.0 on the side?
Well, 302 is much
more. Are you a vanilla Ace fan? Is that what this is all about?
Yeah.
The same thing came up when they announced the 7-liter Corvette engine because people wanted 427. Mm-hmm. So you have people who go either way.
Right.
But I will say that every article I've read about your new car, everybody mentions 5.0 in the lead. So it's like you guys are getting that message out and people are really taking it.
Yeah.
Well, remember, they got bashed when they went from the 5.0 to the 4.6 with...
Yeah.
Which was that was late 90s, right?
Yeah.
Like 98 or so, or 97?
Well, actually, it was the last time we had a 5-liter was 95.
Okay.
That's the last time we had a 5-liter.
Well, not only that, but the 4.6 was that modular engine family, which was an engine that was designed to go through the manufacturing process efficiently, not necessarily to be the best engine, as it were.
Hey, that engine did really well for us, right?
Yeah.
But
you're not following the same steps now doing the 5-liter.
Well, it's a new age, man. New technology, new ways of doing business. But when we brought the 5-liter back, we wanted to do it right, bring it back bigger and better than we've ever had it before. And, you know, as you guys experienced today, I mean, that it's got more horsepower, more torque. I mean, it's just in the fuel economy, right?
Well, what, 30 miles to the gallon for the V6, right?
The V6 is 31 miles per gallon. It's 305 horsepower and 31 miles per gallon. No other car has ever been able to achieve that, so that's a first in the industry.
And the 5-liter is what?
It's 26 miles per gallon, 412
Highway.
Horsepower. Highway, yep. 412 horsepower, 390 foot-pounds of torque. And
direct injection?
No, it's not direct injection.
Hmm. So there's still more up to go, as it were, if you got to get even more out of it in the future for CAFE?
When you look at it and you see what direct injection actually gets you in fuel economy, it does help you slightly. But the cost of direct injection, we don't feel is it's worth, you know, it's just not worth the price. So,
well, explain to the audience.
For this application.
For this application, yeah. I mean, we're in both, you know, we've got class-leading fuel economy on the V8, and we've got, you know, obviously class-leading and unprecedented fuel economy in the V6, and we did it without direct injection. So you can do it if you know what you're doing.
Explain to our viewers how you get that combination of fuel economy and horsepower, because it was just a few years ago when there was earlier in the Bush administration, there was talk of pushing CAFE up, and, you know, the automakers always said, oh, you know, we can't get that kind of fuel economy without, you know, making slow cars nobody wants to drive. And now all of a sudden that it's being forced, you're seeing cars that have 300 horsepower with 29 or 31 mpg in the highway. So what's the technology that's doing that for you guys?
Well, technology's come a long way, and both of these engines are all aluminum, and they have TIVCT, or twin independent variable cam timing technology, allowing us to independently control the intake and exhaust valves. And when you do that, it really opens up a new world of what you can do and how you can optimize the combustion chamber. So, you know, we're able to take that technology, and plus we have other technology in the engine like piston oil squirters. So we actually take the oil, shoot it at the bottom side of the piston, cooling down the piston, allowing us to put more spark in. And then the oil, the fact that the oil is getting warmer quicker, that reduces the drag on the engine too. So all of that, you know, everything works together to to improve fuel economy. So it's the technology in the engines of today. When you have, I mean, this thing is producing, the 5 liter is producing 83 horsepower per liter. I mean, that's world class.
That's really good for naturally aspirated. Right. That's awesome. I imagine cooling the pistons too with the oil squirters allows you to bump up the compression some, or?
We're at 11 to 1 compression.
Wow. Well, no wonder.
Yeah. So it does allow you to do quite a bit. So that combined with, you know, new for 2011, we put EPAS, or electronic power assisted steering. I started to tell you that when you were driving a little bit.
You guys never had that before, right?
Not in the Mustang, no. So that's new for 2011. Took us a long time to get it tuned just right so that you get that precise steering that you're looking for when you're pushing the car hard. You know, you want it to be responsive and firm, but then when you're in parking lot type maneuvers, you know, you can ease up the efforts quite a bit. That technology also allows us to do cool things like active nibble compensation. So if you're getting a little bit of vibration in the steering wheel, we can knock it right out.
No, wait, what do you call it again?
Active nibble compensation. Yeah.
It's a good word.
Yeah. You know the term nibble? Nibble is especially when you get... Okay. Yeah,
No, go ahead.
Well, nibble is when where you especially notice it. Is if you've ever driven on pavement with grooves in it, like they'll do to displace water, you'll get this like little...
275 going south.
It's called nibble. You feel the car sort of moving around a little, but that's nibble.
Yep, and we can knock nibble right out. The other thing that we can do with this technology is we can compensate for road crown. So once we understand, you know, the input that you're putting into the wheel to compensate for the crown, we'll compensate for you. So there's some pretty cool technology.
That's pretty slick.
Yeah, even crosswinds, we can compensate for crosswinds.
Because I've driven in a lot of sports cars, especially when you get tires, real wide tires with a crown on the road. Man, you're constantly sawing at the wheel just to keep it going straight.
Yeah, so that technology is fantastic. And that, because it's EPAS, it takes the load off of the engine. So we don't have a hydraulic pump on the engine any longer. So that takes load off of the engine, which helps you with fuel economy. And then we've got two brand new 6-speed transmissions for 2011, and both the auto and the manual. And so that helps us with fuel economy. We've got wider gear ratios, and that allows us to get the performance feel that you guys felt when you stomped on it. But it also, at cruising speeds, allows us to achieve that highway fuel that we were talking about. And then it's the total picture. I mean, we've got tons of improvements in aerodynamics. We improved the aero by 4%. In 2011. So all of that comes together. You get the right tire technologies and, you know, you can get the type of numbers that we're talking about. But it is a total solution. It's not just one. There's not one silver bullet. It's got to look at everything.
How much more can you wring out of the combustion engine? I mean, that's sort of everyone talks about hybrid or clean diesel. There's a lot more in just a gasoline engine that can be done, isn't there?
Well, we're going to continue to push the envelope. I'll tell you that. I mean, clearly, we're doing things that no one else has ever done. So how much more? I don't know. But I'll tell you what, we're going to go find out.
Well, you're going to have to, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, EPA just came out today and said pass cars have to hit whatever it is, 37.8 miles per gallon by 2016. So how does Mustang pull its load 5 years from now, 6 years from now?
We're working on that.
Can you do less? I mean, I saw you successfully deflected something where somebody asked you about four-cylinder EcoBoost. So...
Give us
a different deflection.
I didn't deflect it. That is a great technology, right? We do know that most of our customers like naturally aspirated engines. So we figured out a way to give them that and not compromise anything. But as we start talking about numbers like you're referring to with fuel economy, we're going to have to look at all of the tools in the toolbox, and including the technology. So,
does it get to the point where you just tell customers, hey, we can only build X amount of these? Whoever wants to buy them, get in line.
Well, I hope we don't come to that because I want to put a Mustang in everybody's garage. But we'll figure out the right technologies. And I'm not trying to skirt the issue. It's I don't know where we go. Like I said, we've achieved quite a bit in 2011. We know we have to go further, and we're going to go further. We're going to keep our minds open to all technologies, and we'll see where we go from there. But the EcoBoost has been a fantastic. I mean, you guys have driven the EcoBoost, right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a phenomenal.
Well, the other thing, too, is when you put twin turbos on an engine, the whole turbo lag issue pretty much disappears. And you can get a driving experience that's much closer to a naturally aspirated one.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that you have to remember, too, is you want to keep the technologies at cost efficient as well, right? I mean, the Mustang is all about being fast, fun, and affordable, and now fuel efficient. But if you look at being affordable, I mean, you get into the 305 horsepower V6 for just under $23,000, and you're going to get into that V8 5-liter for just over $30,000. I mean, you know, it's the value equation is what we're also very aware of, and we need to make sure that we constantly deliver.
You guys have always done that. I think that's the thing that always brings me back to recommending the Mustang, is you've always managed to keep costs down so much that it was always a good story to tell, but compared to the Camaro or compared to whatever, it was like, man, this is really worth it. Yeah. And we were talking earlier when we were driving about IRS. So tell me sort of where, I'm not talking about tax day, but
yeah.
Of course, tell me about, you know, you were describing some things in the car that said now the discussion is totally moot.
Yeah.
And well, we're talking independent rear suspension.
Independent rear suspension.
Anyone not keeping up with those.
That's been an ongoing debate for some time. You know, you guys, I'm sure, have been in a lot of discussions yourselves. You know, we've taken a live rear axle probably farther than anyone has ever taken it, right? Probably farther than anybody thought we could take it. And we make no excuses for that. That car performs in any environment that you want to put it on, whether it be an autocross, whether it be, and also, you know, our customers love to do straight line type accelerations, drag strips, things like that, right? And there's no better axle to have than a solid rear axle. So I believe we proved the last week we had a bunch of the media, your team was out there, and that we know how to execute a live rear axle better than our competition executes an independent rear suspension.
So give us some examples. What did you do to make sure that the back wheels really stay planted?
Well, we changed a lot of the suspension bit. I mean, this has evolved over the years, right? We've been working on this live rear axle and tuning it in for quite some time now. But in 2011, we did go even further. We modified our lower control arms and made sure that we changed the geometry such that you're putting more power now down. And I think you mentioned, John, you didn't feel the wheel hop. You didn't get...
I did not.
Yeah, right.
And
so
tromping on it.
Yeah, and so, you know, changing that geometry back there helps to mitigate all of that. So the more power we put in the machine, the more we understand where we need to change the geometry so that we don't get ourselves into trouble. But if you know what you're doing, you can execute it, you know, with no excuses.
Is it just at the proving ground, or is a lot of it computer simulation that gets you along on that?
Both. And we do a lot of work on tracks. I mean, we go, you know, we're on tracks around the country all the time, checking out every different road surface, all the different types of, straight line curves. I mean, so we're out doing a lot of work on tracks, make sure we understand how to get the handling.
Initially, you guys didn't use the independent suspension as a cost reason. I mean, wasn't that for this generation of car?
You know, there is a cost element, obviously, but there's also a weight element. I mean, you know, Mustang is 250 pounds lighter than its next competitor, which is Camaro.
Yeah, but that's not much to brag about. Camaro's a heavy car.
Well, I know, but we're the lightest in the class right now. And I'll tell you, part of that, it can be attributed to independent rear suspension. That in itself is about, depending on the suspension system, 60 to 80 pounds, you know, right there in that suspension. So, you know what? If each one's got its pros and cons, right? A poorly executed independent rear suspension is pretty bad. And so just the fact that you have IRS doesn't mean that it's fantastic. So
not only that, but we need to live in a universe where there are some unique traits about cars, and everything can't be IRS, backup camera, nav,
right.
You know, and it's good that you guys have some things that some people might say that's really, you know, farm technology, but you guys prove that it actually can be done really well. Yeah. So
no, there's been these debates. I mean, you know, when GM was using pushrod engines for a long time.
Yep.
But they got great performance out of them.
And good fuel
still
economy.
Do.
I was gonna say,
right.
Still do, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And there's a big cost savings in that.
Yeah.
Like $800 an engine.
Yeah.
Is it really that high?
Is it that high? I don't know.
$800. Wow.
That's a lot.
That's a lot
that
of money.
That sure is, yeah.
A lot of money.
Yeah.
But speaking of engines, talk about how you got the sound in this. I haven't driven the V6 yet, so I can't judge that. But
great.
This 5-liter sounds fantastic. Yeah,
totally stock exhaust on that car that
totally
we just drove, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's totally stock. Well, the sound, I tell you, I mean, there's a couple of things. You know, number one, we went to get all of the sound that you don't want to hear out of the car, the road noise, the wind noise, things like that. But when you do that, all the good sound, that sound that you heard today, that also goes away too. So you got to figure out how to get that back in. I mean, those exhaust systems, the V6 has standard dual exhaust in 2011, and it sounds fantastic too. But each one is finely tuned, and we spend a lot of time and money working on getting that sound that you heard today. But it's
both. It's not just the exhaust, the induction
yes,
noise
both
too.
Of, both of them. You got it. Absolutely. You got to love what you're hearing coming in, and you got to love what you're hearing going out. And we spent a lot of time. Mustang sound is legendary. When you start up a Mustang, everybody knows that was a Mustang that just started up. And everyone loved our 4.6 liter sound. 5.0 definitely doesn't disappoint, as you know. But and you heard the gurgling and burping. And, yeah, it's it's something that we're proud of because it was not easy to get that good sound back into that cabin. So, you know, we've got an induction sound tube. So some of that induction noise you heard, there's an induction tube that brings that noise into the cabin.
How does that work? That you actually have to engineer something to get the sound back in because you're insulating to keep every other sound out.
Yeah, it's not artificial. It's brought in from the intake of the engine. So you're actually picking up the intake, but we do pipe it right back into the cabin so that you can hear it. Otherwise, like I said, you seal off all the bad stuff. You don't get the good stuff in. So it's a tube that comes off the induction tube, goes into a diaphragm cavity, and then that comes out and creates a sound.
Has that ever been done before?
I don't believe it has.
I've never heard of anybody running a tube inside the car so you can hear the engine better.
Yeah,
I don't. Can I pull my ear down and get a specific point where I can hear it more, too?
Well, you know what? Not in 2011, you can't. We've made sure that we've evenly distributed across the car so that mm-hmm. it was very natural and balanced. 2011 is all about balancing the vehicles.
But was that tube there before or no?
We did it first time in 2010.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I got to get a picture of that. Yeah, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, I'll show you. I'll show you before I leave here today. Yeah. Yeah, so it's that type of technology that we had to reach out and grabbed in order to keep that Mustang legendary sound.
Who was the keeper of the sound? Who said, nah, go back. We need different pipes. We need different Helmholtz resonator. We need whatever it is.
Yeah.
Who is the keeper of the sound on the Mustang?
We have engineers that's all they live for is to figure out how to get that Mustang sound just right. There's a jury of us that evaluate and determine whether it's meeting the Mustang DNA or not. Yeah, we've got a couple engineers that they live and die just to create that sound. So it's very cool. People are very energized about stuff like that.
That is very cool.
Yeah.
The only problem the Mustang has
yep.
is the Camaro continues to outsell it. We saw March sales today, and I was
8,900 to 5,900. I mean, that's
yeah.
This is the widest margin yet.
Well, we retained the sales leadership last year. This year, you know,
but Camaro didn't sell for the whole year last year. I mean, they were up early in the year.
Yeah, no, they didn't. Our 2010 model came out just before they came out with the Camaro. But, yeah, no, you're right. But you know what? We know that at the end of last year, look, Camaro's been out of the business for 7 years. There's a lot of pent-up demand, and there's no doubt. And there's Camaro lovers and there's Mustang lovers. So we understand all of that, and we know who they're selling to and what's going on. We feel very confident this year of our sales and where we're going to be. I mean, number one, these engines were very anticipated. People have been wondering, tell me about the 5-liter. You don't know how many letters I got about. Come on, I know you're doing it. Come on, I know you're doing it. Just tell me, right? So they've been highly anticipated, and we know that hurt us at the end of last year. And really, at the end of last year, it leaked out that the 5-liter was definitely coming and that there was a new V6 on its way, too. So,
and that hurt you guys' sales?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, people, because, you know, people knew that they were coming, right? So this year, the engines are here. They're going to be in showrooms very soon.
How soon?
Very soon. And we feel very good about where we are with sales this year. We feel we're going to be very strong. I mean, the orders, we're already, sales for this time a year ago, Mustang is up 57% in its sales. And the orders that we're seeing for the new model, it's three times what it was last year at this time. So we know that people have been waiting for the engines.
How much, how many can you guys build a month?
The plant can run quite a few. I mean, right now we're gearing up to build about 100,000 a year, but we are not constrained at the plant. The plant, it's both a Ford and a Mazda plant,
right?
And it has capacity to build as many Mustangs as we need to build. We are not constrained.
Yeah, Mazda's not putting any production constraints on that plant.
Yeah, no, they are not. It is what it is, and we, like I said, we are not constrained. We can build as many Mustangs as we need to build.
What about racing this car? I mean, I'm a kid who grew up in the heyday of the Trans Am series when it was war, Camaro versus Mustang, later Challenger. How do you get back to that? I mean, when Peter DeLorenzo's here, he's always arguing this is what NASCAR should be racing.
I agree with him on that. I mean, I'm sorry, Fusion versus Impala. I mean, the Fusion's a nice car, but it's a family
car. Camry.
The Impala is a fleet car. I mean, you know, you couldn't pick less exciting names in any of the company's lineups than Camry, Fusion, and Impala. I mean, when you've got Challenger.
Mustang's doing its first nationwide race coming up. So we're getting back into the NASCAR scene?
Yeah, but it's and everybody made a big deal about the Mustang coming back, but you know, it's a front end clip that's better than the decals, mm-hmm. but it ain't a Mustang.
Well, you'd have to change all of NASCAR.
I was going to say that. You'd have to change all of NASCAR.
Well,
for
let's
that.
Change it.
Okay, let's do it.
I mean, I don't see why you cannot incorporate the car of tomorrow's safety features into a Mustang. I don't think it could be that difficult.
Yeah, but it's all of the rules that they've got on you know.
I know, but honestly, I mean, and I'm not a huge racing fan, but I think NASCAR sucks. But if you had Mustang, Camaro, and Challenger in NASCAR, I'd watch it. I mean, to me, you know, Fusion and Impala Camry, it's like strike season baseball when they had, you know, the replacement players come in. I mean, who's going to watch that?
That was a dismal time, wasn't it?
Yeah, yes, it was bad. And that's the way I look at NASCAR now with basically, you know, sort of, you know, NASCARized versions of, you know, family sedans trundling around the track. It's just...
The last 10 laps. Just watch the last 10 laps. It's fun.
Yeah. That's where it's all at.
But it would be so cool if it was, you know, if it was Camaro, Mustang, Challenger. That would be awesome. I don't know what Toyota would do. What are they going to put in there? They'd have to bring the Supra back or something.
Something. Yeah, maybe it'd force their hand on that.
You guys have a pretty good racing program now. You have contingencies and stuff like that at the grassroots level.
And we're out there right now, you know, running the Boss 302 R's. And that's running the new 5-liter engine. And it's doing quite well out there. So... and we work really close with our Ford Racing team. I mean, we're very tight with our Ford Racing team, and we take learnings from the track and bring them into the production car, and it's really good. And they give us feedback into the types of things that they would need to make themselves successful out on the track. So we have a good relationship with them.
Well, we had Jamie Allison here, too, Jamie, so you're going to help him sell a whole bunch more crate engines,
absolutely.
I'm sure.
Yeah, Jamie and I, we meet all the time, and we bring the whole Mustang team together once a month to talk about where we're going, what we're doing, how Jamie and his team are doing. And so, yeah, it's really cool.
Well, maybe we ought to talk about some of the news of the week and then come back to Mustang and to Rapid Fire.
But, sure.
I guess the big news this week, David, is car sales are, like, unbelievably good for March.
It was a big month. I mean, you know, look, the economy is getting a bit better. It's still not all the way back, obviously, or, you know, it's baby steps. But there's a bit more consumer confidence. The news hasn't been all that bad. And, look, Toyota drove a lot of this with a lot of the big deals they had out there, 0% financing and some other deals. And, you know, some other companies followed. So you had a lot of money being put in the market, even in the luxury end. BMW's got some very aggressive leasing going on.
Though their sales weren't all that great.
No, they weren't.
3% or something.
Yeah, they were up 3%, actually. Yeah, so it wasn't a great month for them. But you do have a lot of money going into the market. I mean, somebody like BMW, look at where would they have been if they didn't have that money out there? You know, it would have been a lot worse. So, you know, it inflates the whole market quite a bit.
Do you think it was a great month, though? I mean,
no, I don't think it was great.
It was 11.7 SAR, and so against 09, it looks great. But that's the folly of every time we talk about it.
Exactly,
all along.
You know? I mean, that's what I mean by baby steps of a recovery. It wasn't a great month. I mean, look, this was sort of the morning of the clever ruse on GM's part, too, is, you know, they announced their sales at 10:45 in the morning. So starting at, I think it was 9:54, they start putting out one headline press releases. Chevy sales up, I think it was 45%. A couple minutes later, Buick sales up 76%. And then GMC up, you know, I think it was 46%. And then Cadillac up 42%. And that's all it says. So for almost an hour, you have nothing but these headlines from GM saying that their sales are up huge for each of their four core brands. Because, and this was very smart on their part, because they know that the news wires and CNBC, for that first hour, all they're going to do is, you know, And you know, I'm with Bloomberg Businessweek. I write for both. Bloomberg's going to have, you know, Chevy sales up, you know, 45%. And that's going to be on all the news wires for a while until they actually have to explain the numbers and answer some questions. And then, you know, there's going to be the breathless person on CNBC talking about Warren Buffett. And then the woman's going to say, oh, this just in, Chevy sales up 45%. Oh, Buick sales up 76%. And that's all people are going to get.
Right.
Then once you dig into their numbers, fleet sales were up 64% for the month. They did pull back on incentives, which is good, and they do have some really hot vehicles. But their market share, and you had
down,
to wait,
down.
Is down,
right.
17.6%, you know, which is low for them, and they're shooting for 20. Now, a lot of it's because the four brands they're getting rid of, Saturn, Saab, Hummer, and Pontiac, but they're not getting a lot of those buyers back is the problem. 17.6% market share is not good. But they did play this clever game where for an hour.
Too bad they don't have any stock to sell, though. Yeah. If CNBC wants to pump that stock, they can't.
It was a good PR move. The only thing is you know, we dig into the numbers later. They didn't have a terrible month, but it wasn't a great one either. And I'd sort of say that one stat for the whole industry. I mean, Toyota's incentives obviously did very well because they were up 35%. Mm-hmm. Nissan had a really good month.
Nissan was real strong.
You know who else had a lousy month? Honda.
Honda did not have a good month.
Although I saw Insight was up crazy. That was a really big bump for them.
But Fusion Hybrid outsold the Honda Insight.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, and the Fusion Hybrid is a significantly more expensive car than the Honda.
Look, the Honda Insight, and I've written about this, is a flop.
It is.
It is. I mean, I'm sorry.
Well, it was up, like, you know, from 500 units last year this time to whatever it was. So
they're like 1,600 units. Yawn.
Yeah. You know who had a really bad month was Suzuki, we were talking about earlier. And, you know, everybody's been talking about how great the Kizashi is. I haven't actually driven it, but it hasn't really moved the needle at all for them in sales because they sold something like 2,200 cars, which is about the level that Porsche sold last month. So I would imagine that Porsche margins are a little bit better than Suzuki margins.
Probably.
Just a guess.
Just a tad bit.
But you guys did really well. You guys sold 50,000 more cars this month or last month than you did in 2009.
That was a good month for us.
Just to put it in perspective, Suzuki sales are down 73% from a year ago.
Wow.
And that's from one of the worst car market and historic low.
Right. I'm stunned by how Suzuki is. Yeah. It's
I think they're just folding up the tent at this point.
Are they, though? I mean, Kizashi was the expression of them wanting to have actual product.
I know, but I mean, you're down this low. How often do you see ads for Suzuki or any kind of promotion? I hardly see anything from them.
No, they should sponsor the show.
Then we'll start saying they're great. No, we can't be bought. But, you know, it's, you know, Mitsubishi and Suzuki, there's just not enough there to really support.
Another two brands, hot month, Volkswagen, Audi. They did fantastic. Yeah. Up real strong. So, yeah, you know, to your point, Riley, I mean, we broke a million units for the month, and we're all going, wahoo, we broke a million. But, you know, 2-3 years ago, we would have said, oh, my God, what a disaster.
Yeah.
So it all depends.
I mean, the only good thing here is that companies have cut so much that they can kind of make some money at this level of sales, or at least get near breaking even. I mean, my fearless prediction is GM's going to make money in the fourth quarter, when they announce those numbers next week or the week after. It's going to be a lousy quarter. But first quarter, that's the first quarter where the VIBA deal kicks in, so they're not paying health care costs out of pocket. A lot of the restructuring costs, they're going to dump all of that into the 2009 numbers that they're going to announce fairly soon. And then, you know, they've been behind on production for full-size SUVs. The big crossovers like the Enclave and Buick Enclave, Chevy Traverse, and the GMC Acadia, Chevy Equinox has been red hot. Camaro has been red hot. Buick LaCrosse is doing really well. So they're boosting production for all this stuff. And now this is a one timer, but remember they had to take those 686 dealers back. I think it was 686 or whatever the number was. They're going to have to fill all those lots with cars. That's going to be you're going to see a very good, you know, relatively
great
speaking.
Point. That's a real good point.
600 something dealers, and you got to give them all, you know, if you got to give them all 100 cars, that's a pretty good chunk of production.
Well, they better do it fast because Big Ed is not happy.
Yeah,
I mean,
he
wants
not
it right now.
Right.
I was talking with a friend of mine at GM, and you know, the structure GM is you guys were talking about a couple weeks ago, but there's basically a head of sales position that isn't filled. And so that's all going through Royce and Whitaker wants sales like today. And the fact that they can't get more Equinox is a serious problem because people actually do want that car, and for the first time they can't actually get it to them.
And did you hear what they're going to do, too? They're going to do complete bodies in Kami, the plant in Canada, ship them to Oshawa, Canada, for paint and final assembly.
Come on.
No, this is what they're going to do.
Sounds efficient.
And, I mean, this is how we used to do it back in the 20s, right? Things were shipped around and we stopped doing it. I say we, I mean the auto industry, because loading cars up on, and you know this,
oh my God.
Loading them, moving them, unloading that's, them, moving them, that's dings, dents, quality problems.
Absolutely. I don't know how they're going to keep
I was stunned when I heard they were going to do that.
It's not that far from Ingersoll to Oshawa, but
it doesn't matter.
All the moving
it doesn't matter if it's across the street, David. It's still the same amount
of
moving, unloading. It's crazy.
Well, look, this, not, I mean, this is a problem, but it's probably the best problem GM has had in, in about 20 years because, you know, the other problem is you're discounting them to get rid of them. But, you know, they've got, you know, they're adding, what did they say? They're adding overtime at the Camaro plant in Oshawa, and they're adding, I think they said they're going to max out overtime at Arlington for the full-size SUVs and in Fort Wayne for the pickups. So you're going to see some...
Well, those are good signs.
Yeah.
Those are very good signs.
In fact, this month, I mean, pickup sales are up. The bigger vehicles that you don't think would be part of this, you know, unstable economy, people came in and bought big stuff this month, which is why the transaction prices are
well,
much higher.
You know, you look at... I was looking through all the luxury sales brands today, and you look at the hot... You know, Mercedes had a good month. Cadillac was up, but it was all due to SRX and Escalade.
Mm-hmm.
CTS got hammered.
Huh.
CTS had a bad month. And Lexus had a good month. And you look at where it was with Lexus, it was SUVs. It was the GL for Mercedes, and it was the SRX for Cadillac. So people are buying SUVs right now. They are buying the bigger stuff. It's, you know, gas has been relatively cheap for quite a while now, and people just sort of, we're back to normal. I can live with
Ford had a rip-roaring month, too.
Yeah,
I mean, second only to Toyota, I think, in terms of gains.
I didn't see Toyota's gains yet. What?
Toyota was up 35%, I think?
No, it was like 41.
Okay, because we...
Well, I'm going...
Ford brand is 46%.
They predicted... Jim Lentz said at the New York show they'd be up 35, and they actually beat what he...
Well, I'm going by Ward's numbers here, and Ward's does it on a daily selling rate so that you compare like-selling days to like-selling days, and they've got them up at 35%.
Yeah, okay.
So I like the Ward's numbers because, to me, it's a little bit more granular. It's a more apples-to-apples comparison.
Well, it is because there's an extra selling day for the month.
Right. Yeah. And that makes a big difference. In terms of percentages.
Yeah.
But, and same, three of the hottest vehicles at Ford were the F-150, of course.
Yep.
The Escape, oh my God, that thing is red hot. Yeah. I can't believe it.
Yeah, they can't get enough of them. It's
and
great.
The Edge. The Edge is doing fantastic right
now. Phenomenal. Yeah, it is.
And your old car, the Taurus, is starting to show some real numbers
it
now.
Is. It's a beautiful car, I'll tell you. Have you driven it?
Oh, yeah, every model of it.
Yeah, it's very, very nice. So, no, it's a great month. We're excited. We're excited. I mean, there's hope out there, right?
And the other big news, Riley, the Nissan Leaf priced at $32,000 and change. I was stunned by that price.
And with the tax credit, it's $25,000. Mm-hmm. And if you live in Georgia, you get an extra $5,000, so it's $20,000.
Or California.
You get $5,000 in California.
But do you lease the battery separately on that?
The battery? No.
No,
you have to buy the charging
station.
That includes battery. Okay.
But the charging station is $2,000 or something.
Still, you're still talking $32,000 for a compact car.
That's a lot of money.
I know, but, you know.
It's really $25,000 with the credit for a while.
Yeah,
so 25.
The credits run out.
They do, but they can sell it at 25-ish for, and they can lease it at that price too.
They're going to sell some and lease some. They're not going to do the what they two up for? Didn't they say 100,000 and then 300,000 eventually or something like that?
No,
I know that's global, but come on.
It's global, but no, you're right. But here's what I thought was so interesting about the price was Mitsubishi was the first to come out with a first major car manufacturer. They have this iMiEV. And it's like in Japan, you can only buy it now. It's $46,000. And then GM's been talking about the true cost of the Volt before any credit is $40,000. The Leaf comes out at $32,000, and I'm going, oh, my God.
Carlos is really, he's thinking, I better go big with this, right?
Well, not only that, but what I find interesting, in Japan, they're selling the Leaf for over $40,000.
Really?
So it makes you wonder how much they're going to lose on everyone they sell here.
It sure does.
Well, you're probably right.
I mean, they're going to have to, right?
Right.
Because you're still talking battery costs, depending on who you talk to, anywhere from 500 to 1,000 per kilowatt hour. And that's, what is it, 18 kilowatt hours or 20?
I don't know off the top of my head.
I can't remember either. But, you know, so, you know, you're talking, let's call it 10,000 roughly for batteries, not for Leaf specifically, but for any of these cars, even Volt. You know, that's... you know, you're going to have to eat costs if you're going to sell them anywhere near market price for that kind of vehicle.
Well,
I'm not saying don't do it. I like to keep all this stuff.
I like
stuff.
The idea of vehicles
in a sober perspective.
I mean, vehicles as marketing. I mean, most marketing budgets are wasted. You know, I'd rather give the money to an engineer and come up with a really great program, even if you lose money.
See, now, that I agree with, and it's a conversation I had with Lutz a long time ago, and it was, you know, kind of before he was really on board with hybrids. And, you know, I just said, you know, I go on some of the websites where Prius owners are bragging about the fuel economy they got in the same way that Mustang or Corvette owners are bragging about their 0 to 60 times. And, you know, both crowds are geeks. But they're both enthusiastic about their cars.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is. You know,
I just saw a fascinating presentation today, though. I was at this conference earlier today, and there was a guy, I'm trying to remember now, I should get out my notes. I think he was from Bosch, looking from a well-to-wheel basis. That is, pumping up oil out of the ground, shipping it, refining it, putting it on a ship, moving it across the country, well-to-wheel for diesel, gasoline, electric, hybrid, da-da-da-da-da, on a CO2 basis, right? CO2 emissions per. And a diesel with B20 and a gasoline engine with 10% ethanol, E10, on a well-to-wheel basis, both of them are better on a CO2 basis than a hybrid or an electric car using the U.S. electric grid average to calculate it. And that's an eye-opener to me. And we need to talk more. I got to get the source and everything.
And the calculations behind all that.
This was all done, but I'm telling you, that was an eye-opener to me.
Well, today's grid is patched together with duct tape and spit, so I totally agree, though, with that calculation.
Well, it's also how much coal is factored into the CO2 and yada-da-da-da.
I mean, look, and this is just me on a soapbox here, but I think there are much more important reasons than CO2 for pushing fuel efficiency. And the main thing is just the economics of relying on foreign oil and the geopolitics of it, because I think we're going to hit peak oil, and that has, you know, big impact on our economy because we import so much more than we can make. Then, I mean, in other words, we're going to hit peak oil in terms of pricing and impact on the economy before the oceans are boiling due to global warming. And it's not that I don't believe in global warming, but I think you know, most reliable energy experts I've talked to said, you know, we're going to hit serious spike in oil prices 2015-16, which is not that far away.
I know, but I talked to those same experts back in 2008, and they assured me that price of gas in this country would never, ever go under $4 a gallon for the rest of my life. And you look at all this oil that they're finding all over the place, that there's this Bakken oil field up in North Dakota and Montana.
I know. I see the same things, but a lot of this stuff they knew was there. They can get it. It's more expensive to get.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, instead of $20 a barrel or $12 a barrel to get, it's $40. Now, you know, between refining costs and profits, $60 a barrel oil is still
cheap,
pretty cheap gasoline for us. So, I mean, I agree with that broadly, that when, you know, it's not going to be $4 a gallon, you know, perpetually. But I could see we're paying what, $2.50, $2.60 now.
That's cheaper than milk.
You know, I could see being in the threes easily for a while. And, you know, 24 MPG car isn't going to cut it if it's over three.
Yeah, they may not. It all depends not so much on the price, but how fast the price goes up. So if we can sort of ease into higher prices when you factor in inflation and hopefully growing income levels, we can tolerate much higher gas prices than we've got right now, as long as we ease into them.
Yeah.
It's like slowly buying new pants because you keep getting fat. And then all of a sudden you look back and you're like, oh, my God, I'm just a mess right now, aren't I?
That's a good analogy. That's good.
Hey, we got to get into rapid fire. It's time for that. Ben, bring up the graphic.
What did I do?
You got a shout out to him. You're in that chair.
Oh. What do I have to say then?
In a DiLorenzo
voice.
Just
shout out to Scotty in Cleveland.
And here's a shout out to Scotty in Cleveland.
We got it done. Okay.
We love you, bro.
Okay. Jim wants to know, how happy is everybody in the Motor City with Toyota's slash and burn cash incentives?
How happy is everybody? Happy.
Nobody's
no,
happy.
Not happy yeah. about that.
No, everybody thought they'd make a bunch of money, and now they got to pour on the incentives.
So look, GM and Ford have done, and Chrysler, even Chrysler, has done a very good job of pulling back on incentives. And then Toyota, because their reputation is so damaged by recalls, has had to buy goodwill back, and it's pulled everybody into this price game. Even Honda has had to respond to it, and they hate incentives more than anybody.
Okay, 007 Mitch wants to know, will the Mustang get four-wheel independent suspension rather than the solid rear axle? How much would the Mustang weigh ideally?
How much would it weigh ideally?
That's a great question. Ideally.
Ideally. Because yeah. we already talked about the independent.
And yeah, we already did that. I mean, ideally, I mean, I'd like to shave another weight class or two out of the Mustang. So
you're talking about another 300 pounds?
Another 300 pounds is what I'd like to see. So if you want to know ideally where I'd like to be, that's where I'd like to be.
Wow. How do you do that without getting unobtainium throughout the whole car?
We're working on it, John.
You really think you can pull that much out?
I think we can pull quite a bit out.
Wow.
It's going to take, you know, some redesign and some you know. Some
you guys have air in the car now?
We do.
Pull that out.
We've done that on some of our versions. We pulled the spare
balsa wood seat frames?
Yeah, balsa wood. Maybe that's next. We'll go into balsa wood.
Corvette's got balsa wood built into the Ford.
Yeah.
Hey, look, what was it? Weren't PT boats in World War II essentially balsa wood? And wasn't the
Kaiser boats?
The Mosquito bomber that the British built was all balsa
Absolutely.
Wood, too, I thought. So.
Would you want to fly it?
Ideas. If it has independent rear,
independent rear, you'll be good.
George from Brooklyn says, can Mitsubishi recover in America, or is the Diamond Star plant, he means here, going to be a black hole?
Mm. It's just a really confusing set of products. I mean, there are great products, Evo, Outlander, but it's just...
You think the Outlander's a great product?
No, but it's acceptable. I mean, it is acceptable, which is about as what you... It's not... Outlander's not great, but it's acceptable, and they could start from there, but the whole portfolio, it's really kind of messy, and it's not something to build upon right now.
It's one of these brands where they don't have style. They don't have any kind of great technology. I mean, what do they have that nobody else has?
They used to have great styling, and they used to be a technological.
Time.
No, you're right. I'm talking 20 years now. But, George, the Diamond Star plant in Bloomington, Illinois, it's a black hole, man. That thing has got to be operating on a fraction of what's there. Comment from Legend in My Mind. Are crossovers still popular? Will they continue to be so, or is this a transition back to proper wagons and hatches?
You know, crossovers were hotter than a $2 pistol this past month. I mean, especially in luxury. So, yeah, that's, well, Terrain and Equinox and Escape crossovers, yeah.
Right, RAV4,
CR-V. That is what's
very popular, I mean.
Yeah, I dare say it's the hottest segment in the market right now.
I would say so.
I'd have to dig that in.
The fastest growing segment, for sure.
I mean, Explorer's going to be a crossover.
Yeah.
What isn't going to be a crossover other than the Mustang, of course?
Although, in terms of percentage
Mustang's
gains,
not going to go crossover.
In terms of percentage gains, it's probably pony cars that are the hottest segment.
but probably. Right. Hey, we got some phone calls. Ben, let's bring one of them in.
Hey, guys. This is Frank in West Haven, Connecticut. I'm just calling in with an observation that I noticed looking at the sales numbers from the last month. It seems like all the GM products, Malibu and smaller, and even the small trucks, are being outsold by their Ford counterparts. But on the opposite side, all the large GM cars and trucks seem to be pretty much outselling their Ford competition. And I was wondering what you guys thought of this, if there was, you know, if it looks like Ford is going to be doing anything with Lincoln the Mercury, or if it seems like the new Cruze is actually going to be able to compete with the Focus. Thanks.
You know, I'd have to go down through a sales list and look at it, but where GM has new stuff, they tend to do really well against anybody, not just Ford. And, you know, I mean, it's sort of an obvious statement because that's what everybody does. But GM's newest products are what's really hot. To his question about Cruze, I think the Cruze is going to be a really, really good car. And from what I understand, it's really roomy inside and actually has better cabin and passenger space than the Focus. But from the outside,
it's really not good enough from the outside.
Yeah, it's, you know, are people going to look at that design and get in the car to figure out that it's got a lot of other great attributes? And they haven't really done the marketing up front like Ford did with the Fiesta to generate a ton of buzz beforehand to get people into it. So not enough marketing so far and not enough styling to draw people to it. I think that's going to be a problem for them.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy Jones from Dallas wants to know, can you comment on the new products that were unveiled at the New York Auto Show, Scions, Nissans, et cetera?
The Kia Optima, the new sedan, unbelievable. I mean, the photos of that thing look so great. It's that the German designer, Peter, what's his
Schreier.
Last name? Yeah.
Peter Schreier.
Finally, that language is starting to filter throughout the Kia range. And I used to think that Hyundai was the better of it, and they probably still are today. But you can look 3-4 years down the road, and Kia is really going to have some good stuff.
Well, you know, all the Hyundai stuff was done by a guy named Joel Piskowski.
Yeah.
And,
he's from Michigan, Audi now?
From Michigan.
Did he Mercedes?
No, he went to Mercedes, and then they eliminated his position.
Really?
He's not there. I'm
he's
serious.
A free agent now?
He's a free agent now. And wow, if I were Hyundai, I'd try to snap that guy back up. But I think they stole another GM guy whose name I'm blanking out on right now.
Yeah.
Someone ought to grab Joel because he's pretty good.
Joel's excellent. He is excellent. Rumblestrip says, a question for David Welch. Is that your 03 Cooper S that's been for sale in the local Craigslist?
No, it isn't. I'm thinking of selling it to buy something newer and sportier. I don't know. But no, it's not.
Not yours. Hey, we've got some more phone calls. Ben, let's bring in another one.
Hi, John. My name is Marcellus Maxine. I'm a resident of Los Angeles, California. I'm looking at your show today. I just wanted to comment about what you guys were saying about Cadillac. Cadillac is a premium brand still. To me, Audi never could compare to Cadillac ever. Just wanted to say I love your show. I'm a member. I'm from Los Angeles. I've always watched Autoline Detroit. I'm a big General Motors fan. Go GM. I drive a Chevrolet.
Thanks for the comment. Yeah. We really appreciate it. And yeah, I mean, as we've been talking about, all the new stuff GM's got is pretty good. They just got to keep on doing that.
The thing is, Cadillac doesn't have that many cars, so they can focus. Or trucks, so they can focus a little bit more in now. So that looks better.
Yeah, there's been a surprising comeback by Escalade. But it's, you know, you're talking about really three relevant vehicles in the showroom. Escalade only recently, SRX and CTS, and CTS isn't doing that well. They've really lost momentum with that car.
Okay, here's a comment from Marmer. He says, you guys are fond of saying that the ICE, the internal combustion engine, has a lot of potential left. But oil is finite, and carbon probably really is a problem. Why isn't anyone getting serious about hydrogen, not for fuel cells, but to run internal combustion engines? Dave, when are we going to see Mustangs running on hydrogen?
Probably not in the near future. I'm not even in a position to answer about hydrogen technology. I don't know if you guys...
Well, I'll say two things. Number one is it's very easy, actually, to make a piston engine, internal combustion engine, run on hydrogen. There's a number of examples of that. Ford had big Econoline vans running as shuttle buses on that.
Yeah.
BMW's even done liquid hydrogen cars.
Right.
The problem is storing hydrogen. You ever see a hydrogen fuel tank? They got to be designed, they're carbon fiber element wound. They got to be able to fire a machine gun into these things and have the bullets bounce off them. The tanks are horrifically expensive. Secondly is, where are you going to get your hydrogen? I mean, hydrogen stations are hard to come by. You need a hydrogen infrastructure. You cannot drill a hole in the ground and have hydrogen come bubbling up. You have to manufacture hydrogen. To manufacture it takes energy. What energy are you going to use to make your hydrogen? So there's a whole bunch of issues to be resolved. But strangely enough, making a piston engine run on hydrogen is actually a fairly easy thing to do.
That's the sad thing is everything is always an infrastructure problem as much as when you talk about innovation, and we're just so far wedded to what we have today. It's going to be 30 years before we can have anything else, and we're going to make three different bets, so it might take three times as long.
Well, not only that, but, you know, every state and the federal government's broke. So when people talk about, we'll have a hydrogen infrastructure or an electric grid infrastructure or a natural gas infrastructure.
You'd actually totally underestimate the cost of doing that.
Yeah.
It's huge.
I think hydrogen, no matter how you look at it, is a non-starter, because if you're talking about a hydrogen fuel cell car, what a hydrogen fuel cell car is really, what it really is a really expensive and lousy way of storing electricity on board the car. You're storing it in the hydrogen, then you're cracking the hydrogen, and you're charging a battery, and then you're turning an electric motor, which is ridiculous. You should just have a fixed hydrogen station that generates electricity and then find another way to charge the car. And then if it's internal combustion hydrogen, given the infrastructure, it should be better off with natural gas.
That's true.
Yep. Hey, we got another phone call in here. Question about the Mustang is what Ben shows me. Let's hear that, Ben.
Jonathan Brown in Old DePan, New Jersey. Just wanted to comment that new Mustang is awesome. You guys have done a great job with it. You know, even though I'm a GM guy on Corvettes and Z06s and Cadillac CTSs, I dig that new Mustang. You really have done a fantastic job. It's a hot car. Definitely lifts the segment. Is there any possibility that you'll ever do a DSG tranny? Similar, obviously different than the one in the Ford Fiesta, but something like that for the Mustang, you know, able to handle the torque and the horsepower. That's the technology that we're really looking for as enthusiasts, and I just thought I'd ask the question if you're even considering it. Again, the new Mustang's great, the V6, and even better yet, the 412 horsepower V8. Great car. Thanks again, guys.
You can put that in an ad. You can put that in an ad. Yeah. That is so great.
Yeah, we need to get him back.
Yeah, this guy's great. He is.
He comes on all the time. He's in, I forget which town in Jersey he's in.
But. Right.
Well, John, I appreciate your comments, by the way. It's been a lot of hard work by the team, so thank you for those comments. Again, man, you know, we're looking at all our technology options and where we go with transmissions and everything else. I'm not trying to skirt the questions. I can't tell you about our product lineup and our future product plans, but I can assure you that all technologies are being looked at, including what you've mentioned. So we're taking a look at it. We're going to understand what the best thing to do for our customers is. And, we're looking at everything.
Well, Ford's talked a lot about putting DSG with EcoBoost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot to it. But in this country, because we have invested so heavily, or, you know, the big three have invested so heavily in step gear automatic planetary step gear transmissions with torque converters, it's a price premium to go to DSG.
Oh, absolutely.
Whereas in Europe, where they've been, you know, automatics are almost non-existent, and they've got a lot of manual gearbox investment, the price change isn't that much for them.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. And so, and again, it's all about the price equation with Mustang. So, right. That limits us.
Let me just interrupt. Why didn't you guys decide to do paddle shifts in the GT automatic?
The paddle shifts. I'm willing to look at paddle shifters. In fact, I was actually the guy who brought paddle shifters into Ford that you see on the Taurus and other mm-hmm. products that are coming
out. Are they
out.
Right for the Mustang, though?
Well, you know what? That's the question, right? I believe they can
question,
be.
Well, really?
No, I believe they can be, but they have to be done right. Not that we didn't do them right on the Taurus and all that, but this is a sports car. It's got a different demand on what we want those paddle shifters to do. So we are working to see if we can come up with a system that will meet all of the needs of a Mustang. And if we can do that, then yeah, I'll entertain bringing paddle shifters into the Mustang. Absolutely. But right now, it just has to be right. And the hardware and software needs to be able to support what we need it to do. So when you hit that paddle, that thing has to respond now. No delay. It's got to be able to take all of the beatings that you put a sports car through. And so we've got some work to do.
I hate paddle shifters.
I'm not a big fan of them.
Either just give me an automatic so I don't really have to do anything, or give me 6-speed on the floor.
Well, what I hate about the paddle shifters,
I drive a real manual.
If you're going in a straight line, they're great. But if you're really cornering and you've got a shift in the middle of the turn, it's...
That's what I mean. It's just
more
work.
Your hands are never in the right place, or the paddles are never in the right place.
But once a week when you're on the freeway and you have an automatic that has paddle shifters, that does make sense. I don't know if that once a week thing means you need to build it into the platform, but there you go.
We're looking at it. It has to be done right.
Most of them do not shift smoothly.
Well, yeah.
You sort of get this little lurch. I
don't mind that part of it at all. I just want to be able to shift when I want to shift. And so, Frank B. wants to know, how do you think the new CAFE and CO2 regs will affect the Mustang? Will it still have a V8 or just get smaller, lighter, or go EcoBoost for the GT, or keep a blown or turbo V8 for the GT500?
Well, a V8 is extremely important to the Mustang lineup, so I don't see us removing that from our product offering. But, you know, it's going to have a huge effect on the Mustang. I mean, again, we have to continue to deliver the performance that everybody wants, the horsepower that everybody wants, and still be able to do it responsibly. We've done that in 2011. It's going to be a huge challenge going forward. So it's going to have a huge impact on us. But we understand the impact. We understand the challenge. And I can assure you that the company's dedicated to keeping the Mustang, you know, the technology and everything in line so that we can meet that challenge.
And a Mustang without a V8 is like an Apple product without design.
Yeah, right.
So you have to have, no, that's what you, the right. brand is.
Right, you got to have a V8.
So you're not going to bring back the Mustang 2?
Not while I'm in charge.
But could you see a time where there's like a hybrid Mustang or a really high-tech Mustang? Or is that just too sort of anathema to the brand and you don't want to go
yeah,
there?
I'm not so sure. Hybrid Mustang, right? I don't know. That.
Let the next chief engineer in Mustang figure that problem
yeah,
out.
Yeah, let him figure that out.
If you get to a point where gas is really expensive and, you know, fuel economy rules are very tight, I mean, there are other ways to get there probably, but...
High-tech Mustang, yes. Hybrid Mustang, I'm not so sure.
Okay. That's what I figured. I'm just
That's a good soundbite.
Teeing it up.
Yeah.
We know we're right at the top of the hour here, so we'll officially wrap up this. But, Dave, I want to thank you so much for coming on.
I appreciate it.
It's been just terrific talking Mustang and a bunch of other things here with you, too.
I appreciate it. You know, we're proud of the product. We hope everybody gets a chance to get out and at least drive one, and I think you'll see that's pretty cool.
Riley Brennan from AOL Auto has been absolutely excellent having
yeah,
you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And David Welch, great to have you back, man.
Glad to be back, and I feel so powerful in Peter's chair.
It's authoritative.
We want to thank everybody for having tuned in tonight. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/Outoline Detroit. You can follow us at Twitter, twitter.com/Outoline. Can always follow Peter DiLorenzo at autoextremist.com. Follow David Welch's work at businessweek.com. Follow all of Riley's and his 25 writers' work at AOLAutos.com. And you can go down to your latest Ford or nearest Ford dealer and go buy a new Mustang.
There you go.
And soon, he said, the new engines are going to be there. Remember, you can listen to these shows on your BlackBerry or smartphone. Just get a Stitcher app downloaded into it and listen to all that. And thanks, all of you, for having watched us tonight.
Visit our website, OuterlineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Outerline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Outerline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at OuterlineDetroit.tv.
Outerline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Passion for excellence.